My name is Retzef. I was born in Israel. I spent almost 12 years in the Israeli military as an intelligence officer in the area of special operations. And somehow my career took me to academia pretty much by mistake. And over the last 15 years, I'm a faculty member at the MIT Sloan School of Management. This is a university at the at, in Cambridge, Boston, near Boston in the US. And I've been doing research in the area of risk management and advanced analytics, namely using data to inform decisions in various complex environments, but healthcare systems and health public health systems, as well as food and agriculture systems, was a major part of is a major part of my research focus. And during COVID, I've been consulting with several states here in the U.S. Around protecting nursing homes and other issues related to predicting how the pandemic will evolve. And I also I've been interacting with several ministers in Israel and been involved with others in trying to impact what is happening in Israel as well. And let me just start. I personally I'm vaccinated, and I'm in general when I think about vaccines, I think vaccines are one of the most important inventions of medicine or modern medicine. So I'm a very in my base in my baseline, I'm very pro-vaccine. I do not believe that we are in front of a Holocaust. I will try to be a little bit more measured, but I want to take you back and remind you what is the standard process of approving vaccines and drugs in general. This is typically a process that takes about 4 to 5 years. And the first order things that are being tested, specifically at large scale in multiple stages that are being scrutinized, mostly by the FDA and other regulatory authorities. This is a process that is assessing both the efficacy of the drug or the vaccine, as well as the long-term side effects or risks that could happen, and not generically happen, but also to subpopulations, right? When you think about risk, and I'm going to get back to this in a bit, the risk is not uniform to everyone, especially not in the context of COVID. So, and I think that there is a lot of misleading information is being provided to justify certain things without being very specific about what the risk is to different populations. Now, what happened with the COVID vaccines is really an unprecedented process in which, in less than a year, it was not only approved, it was not only allowed to be used, and I don't want to use the word approved because this vaccine was never approved. Even up to now, it's being allowed under a special process that is called emergency use authorization. That's a very special process that was not used too many times in the history by the federal government here in the US. And it's designated to emergency situations when there is an immediate life-threatening condition where it's justified to bypass the regular process. And up to today, right, all the vaccines, not only the one that is being used in Israel, are not approved by the FDA, although for many months it was misleadingly presented by the Ministry of Health in Israel as approved by the FDA, using the word approved. It's not approved, it's unapproved. It's being allowed to be used under emergency authorization. So I'm mentioning that because under this, the only reason why you would even consider using it without further study is if you believe that the population on which you are using it is under an immediate health threat from the condition that this vaccine is supposed to address. And to be frank with you, I think that when it comes to the high-risk population and what is special about COVID-19, that it affects people in a dramatically different way. People that are older, you know, over 55, over 65, you sort of can argue what is the threshold, and people that have certain comorbidities are dramatically affected differently than people that are younger, healthy, and especially kids. So the range between kids and let's say the range between a, let's say a 16-year-old, 15-year-old kid that is healthy and a, an adult of 75-year-old is factor of 8,500 in terms of the risk, more for the older person. That's a very unusual, that's a very specific characteristics of COVID-19 that is not, for example, is not true for flu. Flu actually risks, the risk from flu is high both at the younger ages and at the older ages. What luckily we have with COVID that it actually affects younger and healthier people much, much differently than older and sicker people. So if you ask me, I think that potentially there was a justification to use this emergency use authorization when it comes to older people, higher risk people that had a substantial risk of death or serious illness. And again, I'm not taking away anything that was said here before on the potential other treatments and therapeutics. I think it's a strategic direction that needs to be pursued regardless of anything. And it's unfortunate that we did not pursue that. And in fact, if you would ask me what to recommend to the government here, one of the recommendations to any government, but the government in Israel, one of my recommendations would be to invest much more in additional therapeutics to COVID-19, because I think it should be part of a portfolio of things that we should do against this virus. So that's kind of one thing that I would like to start. And one of the things that has to come with deviation from the main standard process, specifically going in a year or less than a year, or with maybe when it comes to kids, that maybe only 2,000 kids were tested so far in a clinical trial. That means that only 1,000 of them received the vaccine. The other one did not receive it because it's placebo, right? It's a controlled experiment. One of the mandates that should have been implemented with that is a very, very detailed and thorough surveillance program about side effects. And I think that, again, before talking about opinions, a fact is that Israel as a country has nothing of that at the moment. Currently, there is no surveillance that I would call effective surveillance or something near that after side effects. I don't want to get into conspiracy theories that there is an attempt to shut down things, but at the very least, there is no transparent or easy or any way for doctors to report in a systematic way about side effects. And that's very unfortunate because in Israel, you have all the conditions to be leading on that because we have a state level health system that is very coordinated, very integrated. So presumably one could have collected all the data needed to do that, to conduct such a surveillance. In the US, there is a better surveillance, but it's also suffering from some flaws that are characteristics to the very fragmented healthcare system in the US. Just to give you a very illustrative example, if you think about EMS, emergency medical services, in Israel, we have one national emergency service, Magen David Adom. In the US, every town has its own service. So if you want to collect the data in Israel, you just go to one place, you have it. If you want to collect the same data in the US, you're going to have to go and try to integrate across many, 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 many cities. So maybe they have the benefit of the doubt. We in Israel don't have the benefit of the doubt. Okay, so now let's just talk about kids specifically. I think where things come to kids, it's very obvious that there is no emergency threat, right? I think that that's something that's going to be very hard to argue that there is an emergency threat. And I think that here there is a lot of misleading information that unfortunately the Ministry of Health is presenting facts or semi-facts in a very wrong context. So I'm sure you heard that one in six kids that were positive for COVID-19 were hospitalized. That might be maybe a correct fact, but that fact does not mention several other facts that are very, very important to put that number in context. The first number is that between 40 to 70 or even more of those kids that got hospitalized were not hospitalized because of COVID-19. They were hospitalized by because of other medical reasons, many of them were had maybe very significant other medical conditions, unfortunately. And while they were hospitalized, they were tested positive for COVID and were defined as COVID patients. This is something that was discovered already by several studies in the world, that not only in Israel, but across the world, there is an inflated number that many kids that were in the hospital for other medical reasons were classified as COVID-19 patients. By the way, that's true also for adult patients. So when you hear the current numbers of the number of seriously ill patients currently, I would discount this number. And let me just give you a very recent example. We just heard about a kid that played with some explosive material. It exploded in his face. Unfortunately, the kid was rushed to the hospital and was put under coma as part of his treatment and was tested positive. This kid is going to be counted as a serious critical patient, a child that is critically ill with COVID-19. That's going to be the statistics that you're going to hear if you read the newspapers or the Ministry of Health dashboard. So that's kind of one thing. This 106 is something very, very unreliable to think about. The second thing that is even more important, we know that the number of positive cases that were diagnosed is by far less than the true number of people that were exposed to COVID-19. In fact, the Ministry of Health itself did recently a survey of blood samples from kids. There is a bank of blood. This is actually not me. This is data from Ministry of Health that is being done on a regular basis. This is not just specialized to COVID. It's being done to monitor and have a surveillance of different viruses in the community. So it's representative of the population. And that study found that at the ages of 12 to 15, for example, 30% of the samples that were taken in March 2021, very recently, suggested that 30% of them were exposed to COVID-19 and already have antibodies. In a second, I will tell you what that means. But the first thing that means is that it's not unlikely that 30% of the kids in Israel, or even more, are actually already protected against COVID-19. And by the way, natural exposure to the virus is providing you a far more robust and long-term immunity against the virus that is actually more robust against variants of the virus than the vaccine, that the more we learn about it provides probably relatively short-term protection that is more narrow to the part of the virus that was exposed to the body in the vaccine, which is only a small part of the virus, versus when you are naturally exposed, you are exposed to the entire virus and you develop a much more robust set of antibodies, and including a long-term memory of immunity. And that's the reason why we don't see any reinfections or any infections of people that were already exposed. So when we talk about the risk to kids, if you actually assume that 30% of the kids were exposed, the risk is essentially zero, right? And that's being confirmed by very vast studies that came from very recently from the UK that unfortunately are not being publicized by the Ministry of Health, where they looked at close to 500,000 kids that were exposed to COVID-19 and were tested positive, and looked at which one of them was actually in the hospital because of COVID-19. And what they found is that the base risk of mortality is 0.0005%, essentially zero, and similarly the risk of hospitalization. But here's another thing that people are not emphasizing. When you actually look on most of the deaths and most of the hospitalization, these are kids that are not healthy at their baseline. So the risk for healthy kids is even much smaller than that, because the proportion of sick kids, people, kids with oncology, with cancer, kids with some serious heart problems, in the number of deaths from COVID, in the number of children that are hospitalized because of COVID, is far bigger than the proportion in the population. So the risk specifically for healthy kids is actually very, very low. So let me now tell you a little bit more about why do I think that we are under-detecting currently the side effects. And I'm going to talk about a very specific study that we just finished with the Magen David Adom, with the National EMS in Israel. This is based on their data and it was done in collaboration with them. So it's a very reliable data that looked on 2.5 years from 2019 to 2020 and the first half of 2021 on the number of calls to MADA, to the Israeli EMS, for events classified retrospectively by the teams that went and took care of the patient as cardiac arrest. This is when someone drops and their heart stopped breathing, acting, and heart attacks. So the two different classes of calls. And what we've observed from the data is that there is an unexplained dramatic increase in the number of these calls in 2021, specifically 25% when you look on the entire population, but for some subgroups, for example, women at ages 20 to 29, the increase is 83%. This is something really dramatic. And to make things more concerning, when we look on the weekly number of calls throughout this entire period of time, and I just want to remind you, 2019 is a period of time when we don't have COVID-19 and we don't have vaccines. 2020 is a time where we have two waves of the COVID-19 pandemics and we don't have vaccines. And 2021, we have the third wave of pandemic and vaccines. And when we look and analyze it statistically, there is a significant statistical correlation between the vaccine rollout in this specific age group. So we don't look on the number of doses given to the population. We look on the number of doses given to the specific age population and the number of calls in the specific age population, EMS calls, emergency calls. And we see very, very striking statistical correlation between the two, where basically we see an increase once the number of second dose of the vaccine are going up. Then we see a decrease in the number of second doses and in the number of cases. And then we see another increase that can be associated with the decision of Israel to give a single dose to people that recovered from COVID. By the way, that's a special policy, unique policy that only Israel implemented. Nobody else implemented that. This is in spite of the fact that we don't see anyone that was infected being reinfected. But nevertheless, Israel decided to give a single dose to people that recovered. And that single dose seems to be actually correlated with another spike of events. Now, what I'm telling you is not a proof of causality based on the highest scientific threshold that usually people will apply, but it's very concerning because we don't see the same impact during 2020 when we had only the pandemic. So someone that says, hey, these events are maybe the result of the virus needs to explain why we don't see any signal in 2020, right? And we only see the signal when the vaccines are starting. Now, to make things even more concerning, this is actually can be explained by things that we already know about the vaccine. The Ministry of Health already posted a report that connects this vaccine with very probable causal connection to a condition that is called myocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart. It's a life-threatening condition. And they assessed that the risk for young people, specifically age 16 and 19, is 1 in 3,000. Now they try to portray this as a simple condition, but the fact of the matter that when you look on the number of what happened to those kids, half of them spend time in the critical unit, in the critical intensive unit, which means that that was not that easy. And I can tell you that regardless of what the outcome of your out of such a condition, first of all, we don't know the long-term outcomes, but at the very least, that kid will not be able to do any physical exercise for at least 3 to 6 months. I think there are doctors on the call. I think that they will confirm that that's the practice currently. Like if you had myocarditis, if you had a heart inflammation, you have to rest for at least three months or if not 6 months. Now, the other thing about this is that they also only looked on people that positively reported about symptoms that and they were tested and diagnosed positively with myocarditis. And when you read the literature on myocarditis, what you see, and I'm talking about articles from the last 20 years in the top clinical journals, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, these are premier clinical journals, maybe the best clinical journals in the world. So that's a very serious knowledge, very based on knowledge. What we know about this condition that is very hard to diagnose, and the two things that are the two primary facts about this condition is that A, it's often being confused with a heart attack because it's hard to be diagnosed. And the second thing is based on autopsy that people did over the years to young individuals that suddenly got an unexplained cardiac arrest and died, they found that in 12 to 20% of the cases, the reason was an asymptomatic myocarditis that caused that death. Now, what do we see? We actually see exactly an increase in cardiac arrest in ages 16 to 39 and an increase in the heart attacks in ages 16 to 20, 39. So there is a very natural explanation of what we see that is consistent with what we know about myocarditis. And we already know that myocarditis is connected to the vaccine and is primarily connected to young individuals getting the vaccine. Now, let me tell you a few more things. So the one thing that I think we need to do immediately is to check for each one of these individuals, when they were vaccinated, where they were vaccinated, were they exposed to COVID-19 and so forth. And unfortunately, the Ministry of Health is not willing to listen even. We sent that report to the Ministry of Health twice and we haven't heard back. I can tell you that when I sent this report to scientists in the advisory committee to the government of the UK on vaccines, not only the COVID-19 vaccine, on all vaccines, they came back in 5 minutes, put me in touch with the equivalent of the FDA in the UK, and they immediately asked to read the report. And I can tell you that this report is in the hands of other regulatory agencies in other countries without getting into details because they asked me to keep it confidential. But it's not getting any response from the Ministry of Health. And that's to me, regardless again, what is the right thing to do? What I learned as a risk management expert is that if you have processes like that, you are on the way to have a disaster. Because that's a red flag to me if people are not willing to check. How can you argue that you don't want to check something like that? Even if, let's say that there were no vaccines, you just see an increase of conditions that are not supposed to happen to young individuals. Suddenly it's happening and you don't want to check what is going on. That's to me a very concerning sign that decisions are not being made in the right way they're supposed to be made. While we're coming to kids that are at low risk to start with, at extremely low risk, and we want them to get vaccinated. Let me just tell you a few more facts. One of the things that the Ministry of Health committee that was appointed to investigate the myocarditis found was that most of the cases that occurred happened after the second dose. They investigated 62 cases, 56 of them happened after the second dose of the vaccine. When they looked at deaths, they basically decided to look only 2 days after the vaccine shot. That's something that is not clear why they decided to do that. But they also say there's something very interesting, that they say that the other 6 cases, up to the 62, that happened after the first dose, were people that when they were tested, it turned out that they had COVID without knowing that. And that's matching exactly what we see, that we see the association with the second vaccine and with vaccinating people that recovered with a single dose. And now I want to connect that to the early fact that I mentioned to you. if indeed 30% of the kids 12 to 15 are already exposed to COVID-19 and they don't even know about that, what could happen if we go and give them two doses of this vaccine? Think about this. So my point is, we should not think about the decision as not vaccinating or vaccinating everybody with two doses. There are more middle grounds that should be considered. Potentially, there are kids that are higher risk. Maybe we want to vaccinate them. We can do serology tests to kids to see if they were exposed and then make a decision of giving them maybe one dose. By the way, when you look on the trials that Moderna and Pfizer did, one dose was almost bringing everybody to maximal level of protection. The reason why they decided to go with two doses was the frail people, the very frail people, they needed another booster. That's actually something that we see also in flu vaccines, that their immune system of young individuals is very different than the immune system of old people, right? But for some reason, they decided to go with one size fit them all. And I don't think that that's justified. So to summarize what I'm trying to tell you here, A, this vaccine is unapproved. It's only for emergency use authorization. We can not claim, there is no valid claim that kids are under immediate threat that justifies emergency authorization. I don't think that that's valid. And we already know that vaccinating them for the sake of others is not going to be really practical or relevant, because we know that vaccinated people can get infected and infect others. And we also know, as you already heard from others, that kids are not playing a major role in infecting others. So the only question is whether it's worthwhile to give this vaccine to the kids to protect the kids. And in that, if that's the question, given that it's just emergency authorization, just for this, it's not appropriate to give it to them. But to make things worse, we already know, and we're starting to understand more, that there are risks associated, especially for young people. And potentially this is because we are overactivating their immune system, either because we give them two doses or because we give them the vaccine after they were already exposed without knowing that, in a silent way, because there are many asymptomatic infections, especially among kids. And we are potentially going to risk kids with no good reason, including causing them deaths or serious cardiac events. And that's true also for younger individuals. And maybe the most concerning thing here, we, in spite of the fact that we rushed the process that takes 5 years usually to do it in less than a year, we did not follow with the appropriate surveillance system that is mandatory always, but definitely in such a scenario. And Israel has nothing of that, in spite of the fact that there are some concerning signs from data of the Ministry of Health, of Magen David Adom, not my data, their data, right? That this might affect seriously young individuals. So when I look at it and I sum it up, I think that it's irresponsible today to come up with a blanket recommendation and beyond that, just no recommendation, pressure to vaccinate kids with two doses of this vaccine. I think we should take the time. We should understand the risks much, much better and clear some of these risks or validate them and then incorporate them into decision-making. And I don't think in the future, if I kind of what I anticipate, I don't think that in the future kids will have to get two doses anyhow, if any, right? I think it's going to be irresponsible to do something like giving and putting pressure on young individuals and kids to get the two doses of the vaccine. That could cause more harm, significant harm, than bringing any benefit.
Okay. Professor Levy, thank you so much.